This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, we'll talk with the authors of Walking Cincinnati, a guide to walking tours with an insider's look at the Queen City. First up this afternoon, a group of professors and students from Mount St. Joseph University visited Cuba for an educational and cultural trip last month. Joining us to share stories about their trip and what they learned about the people and culture of Cuba are Mount St. Joseph University Associate Professor and Team Multicultural Special Education Program Director, Dr. Clarissa Rosas, Mount St. Joseph Assistant Professor of Literacy Education, Dr. Angela Kinney, and Mount St. Joseph graduate students in the Multicultural Special Education Program, Joanna Clippinger and Natalie Robinson. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Natalie, Joanna, Angela, and Clarissa, thanks for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Clarissa. What were your first impressions when you arrived in Cuba?
Well, it is almost as if the city had just stopped. The buildings, the architecture, and all that is in the 1950s. So that was my first impression. The second impression is how welcoming the people are and how loving they are and how supportive they were to see Americans there.
Natalie, what were your first impressions?
Pretty much the same thing. People were very welcoming, very open to talking to us. You told them that you were from the United States and they give you a big hug, and everyone wanted to talk about politics. And the city, like Dr. Rosas mentioned, it's like it stopped in time. And it was really cool to see all the different types of architecture and the old cars and all of the different historical sites.
We're talking about a lot of cars from the 1950s and that kind of thing,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Joanna, what about you?
I agree with what the other two said. The people were the kindest people that I've ever encountered. They were so friendly. And it's just like Natalie said, when they found out we were Americans, we were like rock stars. I mean, they were just like, oh, you're an American. And I found it funny that nearly everyone we talked to said, oh, I have a cousin, I have an uncle, mm-hmm. I have a so-and-so that lives in the United States. So that was kind of neat. That was, I think, their way of trying to connect to us. I also could not believe how beautiful the country itself is. The architecture was very pretty. It is more colonial, but also the way the Atlantic Ocean came in, you know, right along the coast, it was beautiful. I mean, everything was just beautiful.
Angela?
Well, I'll just echo what everyone else has said. The beauty of the country immediately strikes you, as well as the warmth of the people. I think that really speaks to some of the benefits of these people-to-people types of exchange programs. It would be really easy to just spend the week on a beach, and my impression was a lot of people go there and do that and never really get to see or learn anything about the country and its citizens. But with the program that we traveled in, we were doing that 12 hours a day every day. And so we got to learn a lot about the people, hear their stories, and really get a glimpse of Cuban life that had we just spent the week on the beach, you know, we wouldn't have been able to do that. So,
Clarissa, when you were there, did you get any sense from any of the people that you met about how they feel about normalizing relations with the U.S.? They were glad to see. I guess they probably think this is a good route, don't they?
They absolutely do. They're very excited about the relationship, the start of our relationship again with the United States. So the feeling that we received from the people is that they're very welcoming. They very much are excited about the possibilities of Americans visiting their country.
Now, what places did you visit? Can you just all kind of go around the table and tell me about some of the places that you saw while you were there?
Well, most days we had the opportunity to visit a school of some sort. We were in an elementary school in Old Havana. We visited an elementary school in the rural area, a couple of hours west of Havana, visited a preschool there as well. And then we visited a special education facility in sort of the western outskirts of Havana. So we spent a good portion of our time in schools. The students can share some of the other mm-hmm. cultural activities.
Yeah, Joanna and Natalie, what were some of the things that you did?
Well, we were in Havana. Was it 4 days in Havana? And the other days we went, you know, farther west out into the more rural areas. Other than being in the schools, which I thoroughly enjoyed, we did get to see a lot of historic sites. I don't want to say tourist places because they really weren't tourist traps at all, but just learning about the history of Cuba and learning about the I guess how Cuba was a place that so many other powers came in and just tried to take advantage of, you know, take the resources, take their, including the people, and just take advantage of them, which that, I knew that in history, but, you know, I kind of saw it face to face more of how they were just used by other powers around the world.
Yeah, it gave you a different perspective.
Yes, it really did.
Really did.
We also visited a dance theater where we saw a contemporary dance, which was really neat. Art's really big in Cuba, so there's a lot of artwork. Everyone dances. We also visited in the country. We were able to visit the town and walk around, and it's funny there. It's like going back in time, and people have horses and carriages, and there's also the old cars out there, but it was really neat to see the country and the city as well.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And did you get to see the Eco Village? I know we talked about that last time, Natalie.
Yes, we did, and it was beautiful. We visited the daycare there, which was really fun, working with the little kids there and meeting some of the educators and learning about the history of the Eco Village.
Now, the Eco Village, can you tell me exactly? This is a sustainable village, right? This is something they put together where it's all designed to be environmentally friendly and sustainable, right?
Yes. It was, the French had used the land for coffee plantations, and they had cleared out all of the trees. So the initiative was to reforest it and build more trees and make it an eco village. And I believe it happened in the early 60s that Castro had that done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Clarissa, were you able to get a sense of what everyday life was like for the Cubans, what typical living conditions and working conditions are like for them?
I think we did get a sense of that. The poverty was pretty evident there. However, even though we saw a lot of poverty, the people are very happy. And certainly those that are fortunate to have employment are working. Some of them are working from their homes with their home restaurants that they have there. Others are working for the city and so forth. But what was real interesting about the people there in terms of their daily life is their how happy they are and how pleased they are and how loving they are. And it almost seemed at night that it was, I'd like to use the word partying. They would be dancing, they would be singing, they would be very much inviting. And I'm talking about right outside of their homes, not at a nightclub or anything like that, just having an open door kind of atmosphere. They do struggle. They struggle with a lack of supplies or the kinds of things that we have in the U.S.
Did the locals ever talk to you about the government? Were they comfortable at all criticizing the Cuban government around you?
They were very supportive of their government. They loved to talk about politics, and they were very positive about their government.
I think some of that is, I noticed that when we were at the schools especially, that the children very much are indoctrinated in the revolution and how important that is and what they consider a success that was and how it made living conditions better in Cuba. I did notice that a lot of the times the children would recite poetry to us or sing songs, and quite often it was, you know, based on the revolution or discuss the revolution. And what I found especially interesting on the so many of the chalkboards of the classrooms that we visited, you know, typical chalkboard where it has the date, you know, the day of the week and the date. But then in the Cuban schools underneath that, it would say year 57 of the revolution. And a lot of the revolutionary heroes of Cuba are on the buildings, they're in the schools, pictures of them are in the schools. We went to one school and there was a poster of Hugo Chavez in it, and it said our best friend. So I expected some indoctrination, but it was even more extensive than I was expecting it to be.
Was there any kind of a military presence that you saw when you were there? Not so much?
Not visible. I think there were some monuments to the revolution near our hotel, and there were military regarding that 24 hours a day, but not so much.
We did see policemen.
Police more than
Clarissa, you know, and this kind of applies to everybody who's been on the trip. There are various different images that you have of Cuba before you go there. For each of you, what was maybe your biggest misperception you had about Cuba, and then when you got there, you found out no, that's totally nothing like what I thought or had come to believe. Clarissa?
I think probably the friendliness of the people. I was expecting to be more careful in terms of our travel. You know, whenever you're traveling in a country that does have poverty, there seems to be a bit more pickpocketing and those kinds of things that go on. And certainly Cuba did not feel that way at all, felt very safe as we were walking around during the day and in the evening. So I think my misconception was that perhaps I needed to be more careful. And I'm not saying to not be careful. It's just that it appears to be a very safe place.
I would say the safety as well. I was expecting it to be different, and also the openness of the people. I completely didn't expect them to want to talk about politics. And something I noticed with that is the difference in age groups. It seemed like with the children and the older individuals that they were kind of less open to talking about politics, but people in like their 20s, 30s, 40s were a lot more willing to talk about politics, and I wasn't expecting that.
Joanna?
What I was going to say is Havana has about 2 million people living in it, and I was surprised that I didn't see any homeless. I'm not saying there aren't homeless. I just did not see them. And we were out in the evenings nearly every night, and you in the U.S., you go to major cities, and you do see homeless. I didn't see that in Havana. That surprised me a little bit. And another thing that I was expecting all those old cars from American cars from the 50s and the 40s and stuff. And we did see a lot of those. But I was surprised at how many other makes and models were there. And I would say like maybe 1 out of 20 was an old American car. And there were a lot of other Asian cars, Hyundais, Toyotas, German cars were there. But that kind of surprised me a little bit.
What about you, Angela? What came as a surprise to you? What did you say? I thought this about Cuba before I went, but when you came back, you said, no, wait a minute.
Sure. In my interactions, at least, I didn't find the people as quite as forthcoming in talking about politics, but I was surprised at how willing they were to talk about the economic system and some of the challenges inherent in that, even without being asked about it. They were very open. And we had one guide, for instance, who referred to their current system as being an inverted pyramid, saying that we have all of these overly educated, underemployed people, doctors who have left the profession to become cab drivers because they can earn more money. So a number of people with whom we interacted echo that sentiment that needs to change. We had a hiking guide out in the country who was a physics professor at a university who left because he can earn more money now because he can earn tips being a hiking guide versus being a professor, which is a state paid occupation. So I was surprised by how we got really a sense of this is now with some of the changes that have been instituted in the country sort of becoming a really divided society between those who rely upon the state for their income, receive rations that keep them barely above a poverty level, and then the people who do work in the tourist industry, those are now the desirable occupations. They're doing quite well for themselves. So that surprised me. I hadn't really read anything about that prior to going. So that was new learning for me.
We'll continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, Mount St. Joseph University Associate Professor and Team Multicultural Special Education Program Director, Dr. Clarissa Rosas, Mount St. Joe Assistant Professor of Literacy Education, Dr. Angela Kinney, and Mount St. Joseph graduate students in the Multicultural Special Education Program, Joanna Clippinger and Natalie Robinson. They're sharing their experiences from their recent trip to Cuba as part of an educational and cultural trip, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Natalie, did you meet anybody while you were on this trip that really made an impression on you?
We did. Joanna and I met some of the Cubans who lived across the street, who were very welcoming and taught us to salsa. And they're very friendly, something you don't see as much here. They just invite you into their home and let you hold their baby, offer you coffee, just very welcoming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I found that so odd, as here we were foreigners in this land, and they're like, come on into our house, spend the evening with us. And, you know, they played, and we went in and played music and learned about them, talked to them. The youngest son is 12 in this family, and so I talked to him extensively for quite a while, and I let him know that I do teach school. And so then he kind of warmed up to me and was talking about his school, and he had mentioned that in a few years, he would be going to the high school, or what our equivalent of the high school, and he would get to wear blue. And he was so excited that he was going to get to wear blue. And I had no idea what that meant, but I pretended to be just as excited for him, not knowing what it meant to wear blue at the high school. You know, I'm like, oh, that's wonderful. And then as we were out in the schools and learning about the school system, he gets to wear blue because he is university bound. And so that was a great sense of pride for him, that he didn't have to go to it. He wasn't going to go to a tech school to learn a trade. He would be heading off to the university. And so he was very proud of that. It took me a few days to figure out why blue was so special, but, you know, it was. And he asked for my address. I gave him my address. I have his. He wants to, you know, have correspondence. And I also gave his address to some of my high school students at Madison High School, and they are going to also be his pen pal. So we have a little, you know, international connection there because of this trip.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Now, how do they determine whether they're college bound? Is that all done by testing?
It is by testing and interest.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And let's talk with Brian in Walton, Kentucky. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I just wanted to come in and comment. It was really interesting to hear your interviewees today describe their experiences, because I was wondering how closely they would match up with the ones that I had. And it's word for word the same kind of stuff.
Interesting. You know, okay.
I got to go in 2001, shortly after September 11th, and then right after September 11th in Cuba in October, there was a big hurricane that really knocked Cuba to the ground, and they actually had to negotiate with the United States at that time. So I actually got to go to the U.S. interest section and hear, you know, what our quasi-ambassador had to say about that situation. And then we went to the foreign ministry and got to hear, you know, about the negotiations they had back and forth about whether or not, okay, we'll sell you some food, but will you pay us in dollars or Cuban pesos? Well, we don't want Cuban pesos. It was really interesting time to be there, but, you know, the things that your guests are saying are the same experiences I had. I just wanted to add one thing, that one of the things that I learned at the trip, and I went on an educational visa with my college at the time, is that I learned that the Cuban people are able to do something that I think the American people aren't, which is to kind of divorce the actions of a government from the people that live there. You know, they would say things to me like, oh, we love American people. You know, they love the same things that we do. They love Beatles, Coca-Cola, baseball. You know, the things that are quintessentially American, even though the Beatles are British. But, you know, they would turn around and say, you know, we love you, but, you know, it's your government that we kind of have a problem with. And I find that American people we're unable to do that, you know. We look at a government and its people as kind of conjoined at the hip. And I found it very interesting there to, you know, to see that there's a different perspective of looking at that, I guess.
Well, Brian, thank you for the comments. Yeah, Joanna.
That is exactly what I heard echoed multiple times, that we love Americans, we love your people. Our leaders can't get along, but there's no reason why we shouldn't get along. Very much so. And I think our caller has an excellent point. I never thought of it from that perspective, that, you know, in America, I think we'd be considered unpatriotic to be able to separate, you know, at a certain point, our government and the actions of our government. Whether, I mean, we can disagree with them or agree with them, but to completely separate being an American from American politics is not something that I'd ever really thought about before.
Let's talk with Pete in Cincinnati. Hi, Pete.
Hi. I was curious about, you had mentioned about the, one of the speakers mentioned about the resources, or the revolution, rather, that was 57 years since the revolution. And I was just curious, what kind of resources did the teachers have for instruction?
They were limited, I would say, on instruction. If you, as far as technology, we went to an elementary school that had about 400 students in it, and they were very, very proud. The principal was very, very proud that they had a computer lab. And, you know, in a computer lab in an American school, you know, you have internet accessibility, you have software. They don't really have internet accessibility, but they had software that they used. But out of a school of 400 people, there were 7 computers in their computer lab. And this was still a source of pride to them that they had that. So I found that that was very different. But I also feel that as a resource that they had, is they had the resource of parents and outside groups that would provide things as, like, one of the recess areas that we went to had all of these fabulous papier-mâché toys for the kids to play with, that the parents had provided for them. So I think, you know, what they lack in maybe educational resources, I think they have in people.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation, and let's talk with Joan in Springdale. Hi, Joan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I was wondering if Cuba recognizes the same categories of disability among children that we do here in the United States.
That's an interesting question. While we were visiting the schools, especially those the school for the visually impaired, it was pretty evident that they recognized those the disabilities that are overt in terms of being blind, hard of hearing, deaf, physically impaired. But when I asked a couple of questions from the general ed teacher in terms of children with learning disabilities and those kinds of not so overt, they really didn't, they kept referring back to the physical parts of the disability. So in terms of recognizing our federal categories, no, they really don't. They are really looking at more of what you can visually see in terms of a disability.
Clarissa, Cuba, it's talked about as having an excellent education system. Did you see anything while you were there that you think we should adopt in our own system here in the U.S.?
That's an excellent question. I'm not sure about adopting other than, well, I take that back. One of the resources, and I think Joanna talked about it, was the human resource. Teachers out there spend a good amount of time as part of their contract working in the community in terms of working with families. So they're not just in the classroom, but they actually are required to spend time out in the community with the families that they work with the students. So that brings a very strong relationship between the parents and the children. So it's not a great surprise to see that these parents are in the schools providing resources, handmade resources, because they have that connection with the teachers.
Let's talk with Allie in Middletown. Hi, Allie.
Hi. I am a senior speech pathology major at Miami University, and I'm actually a former student of Joanna Clippinger from Madison High School. And I just wanted to ask some questions about how students in Cuba who have disabilities receive services like speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and things like that.
Well, Allie, good to hear from you, by the way.
Hi.
Hi. One of the things that we noticed at the school for the visually impaired and the blind is they had a special area for the students to, you know, not everyone that is has a visual impairment is blind. Maybe they can have partial vision or, you know, have different ways of seeing things. And they try to diagnose the best way that that individual child can see and teach that child how to approach their learning specifically. And I did appreciate that they really did individualize that for each student and their specific needs.
Let's talk with Diane and Xenia. Hi, Diane.
Good afternoon. Enjoying your interview. I have not heard what agency they worked with in Cuba, what cities they went to in the western provinces. Interested to know that.
Okay.
So our tour was actually arranged for us by Authentic Cuba Travel. We wanted our tour to be customized and focused on education, and so it was necessary for that reason to go through a tour company because they have the contacts and were able to get us permission to able to be in schools. We, as I think Joanna mentioned earlier, we spent the bulk of our time in Havana, and then we traveled for a few days to the Pinar del Rio province, which is west of Havana, and stayed in Vinales. And on our way there, visited the eco village, which is Las Terrazas. But if anyone ever has the opportunity to visit Cuba, I would highly recommend doing the 2 to 3 hour trek west to go to Vinales. It was visually stunning. I have never seen anything like it. So I would highly recommend taking the time to go.
So, Clarissa, would you make this trip again?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, we have submitted the paperwork to the university, to Mount St. Joseph University, to take another group of students next spring. So hopefully the university will approve that, and then we will be doing a very similar trip again with the emphasis with people and children and the school system.
Yeah, Clarissa, Natalie, Joanna, and Angela, thanks to all of you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mount St. Joseph University Associate Professor and Team Multicultural Special Education Program Director, Dr. Clarissa Rosas, Mount St. Joseph Assistant Professor of Literacy Education, Dr. Angela Kinney, and Mount St. Joseph graduate students in the Multicultural Special Education Program, Joanna Clippinger and Natalie Robinson. Coming up, journeys that you can take closer to home, walking Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.